Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. We have a quorum. Members, today we're going to hear about House File 773. Representative Morgan is authoring. It pertains to solar energy. And first, we're going to hear a presentation about the bill. And I understand there's a number of handouts in the packets pertaining to the bill. And after they go through their presentation, I'd like to do clarifying and technical questions from members, and then we'll go through testimony. There's a lot of people that testify on the bill, both for and against, and then what we'll do is we'll alternate the testimony from the public. We'll do a proponent and then an opponent, and we'd cap each speaker at 5 minutes so we can get through as many people as possible. And then members, feel free to ask questions during that point in time, and we won't take that out of the speaker's time, but because I'd like you to ask questions when when the person's up there. But keep in mind that the more questions we ask, the less people we give time to speak, and I think it'd be great if we can get as much testimony for and against in the committee time period. That's why we extended the time. Sorry for the early start time. And with that, Representative Morgan, I'll let you present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First, I'd like to move House File 773 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Energy Policy Omnibus Bill. I also have an amendment. The DE1 amendment makes some technical and clarifying changes, gets the bill in the order I would like it discussed today. So I'd like to move the DE1.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can Representative Morgan go through the DE1 amendment? Or are we going to do that after he moves the amendment?
We're going to do that after he moves the amendment. Does anybody have any objection to voting on the amendment just to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Go ahead, Representative Morgan.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I'm joined today by John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and Lynn Hinkle from the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association to present House File 773. House File 773, the Solar Energy Jobs Act, will set a 10% by 2030 solar energy standard. Studies show implementing the act will create 2,000 jobs in the first year and thousands more over the life of the act. It will strengthen the solar industry that is already present in the state and attract more solar business to our state. The act will bring about $230 million in new investment to Minnesota in year one and more over the life of the act. Further, it will enable us to keep more of our energy dollars here in the state of Minnesota. How does all this work? Well, John Farrell, again from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, has a story to tell that will help explain key elements of the bill. Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm going to be running off a handout which is descriptively titled Solar Energy Jobs Act of 2013. It looks like a PowerPoint slide. And the seven slides is what I'm going to run through as part of the presentation. So just jumping right in to slide number two, as Representative Morgan already mentioned, the main purpose of this bill is to establish a 10% solar energy standard. In that respect, it is very much like the current renewable energy standard. It meets strong ratepayer interest in adding solar to the energy mix. It has a modest goal in the early years and ramps up production over time until 2030. You can see on the chart, the dots represent the solar energy standards that are in place, in force in other states. And Minnesota's 10% solar energy standard would actually be somewhat in the middle of those standards in the early years and over time rise up to within shot of the Department of Energy's SunShot goal of 14% of electricity from solar energy by 2030. So that on this slide then really outlines sort of the baseline component of this legislation. On the next slide then is another key piece, however, which is to aim to give Minnesota residents and businesses a chance to go solar and Minnesota companies a chance to both manufacture and install it. The idea behind this bill is to allow broad participation to install solar at different sizes and in different places. And the design of the bill will mean solar on over 50,000 rooftops in places all across the state, whether that would be Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Eagan, Shoreview, Red Wing, communities across the state. I would like to add one correction, by the way, on this chart, that the bars represent the percentage of capacity as is envisioned by the legislation and not the percentage of projects. So the largest percentage of capacity would be from utility scale solar projects with smaller amounts of capacity from smaller size projects. With those two pieces of the legislation in hand, I want to get to the third important component of this bill, which is payment for production. I like to describe this in short as if there are no kilowatt hours produced, there is no cash. And the first piece of this is what we're calling the value of solar component. There's also a separate handout that gets into much more detail about what the value of solar is, but that I think is more useful for a more technical conversation. What this value of solar component is an improvement on an existing calculation being used by a Texas utility and others that identifies the value of solar electricity to Minnesota utilities. Another way to think of this is essentially the market value of solar, figuring out how this technology and the way that it produces electricity has unique values to the utility system. And you can see in the chart to the right the value that this Austin Energy in Texas, a municipal utility, has put on solar energy based on all of the criteria that are listed on that separate handout and also detailed in the bill. The second part of this that's important to understand about the value of solar is that the utility will buy all solar electricity at that price, no matter where it's produced, whether that's on a residential rooftop, a commercial rooftop, or a large utility scale solar array. And therefore, the utility will also continue to sell all the regular electricity to their customers, which allows them to help recover their fixed costs. This is a little different from some of the existing policy that we've used for solar energy production at a smaller scale. On the next slide is the second part of this payment for production, which again I would like to emphasize, if there are no kilowatt hours, there is no cash. This production-based incentive would replace upfront rebates that we currently use for incentivizing solar energy with a per kilowatt hour incentive. It would be based on project size, so much as I covered in this concept of broad participation on a previous slide, that the incentives would be set based on the size of the project with a recognition that smaller size projects cost a modest amount more. The incentive would be phased out over time, and it would also include a small bonus for Minnesota-made materials with a recognition that we have an existing industry in the state, an industry that we would like to expand in the state, and that using Minnesota-made materials has additional economic benefits that are both quantifiable and worth paying a little bit more for. The two other pieces of context I think that are useful on this slide is that this modest fee aligns with a willingness to pay across the political spectrum for more solar energy, and that in the context of other increases in utility bills, this is actually quite modest. For example, the 1.33%, which is an up to amount, I should add, is comparable to Xcel Energy's recent electricity rate increase of 9%. They function exactly the same way. It would be a one-time increase. And I should point out as well that the 1.33%, if used in its entirety, would still be less than $1 per month on a residential electricity bill. So the payment for production, the value of solar, and the production-based incentive help support the goal of the legislation in deploying solar energy up to 10% by 2030. What this results in on the next slide is what could be termed simplified solar, and I've again described this on a separate handout, which is the handout number 2, which is the process that under this legislation an individual homeowner or small business owner might go through to install a solar array and how that might differ from under current conditions. But essentially what's happening is that the value of solar and this production-based incentive, these payments for production of energy, are combined. A solar generator, whether that's a homeowner or a business or a large developer, signs a standard contract to deliver that electricity at this combined price over 20 years. And this very simple and transparent revenue stream makes it easy to attract private capital into the solar market in Minnesota. That document is something that a homeowner, a business owner, a developer can take to a financer, a bank, a credit union, and it makes it very easy to see what their revenue is likely to be over that time period and how they would be able to pay back that loan. The last slide, then, is essentially what I like to call the bottom line on the Solar Energy Jobs Act. It outlines not only where we would see the state going in terms of the development of solar energy and the number of rooftops but also the jobs and economic development as modeled by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's JEDI economic model, obviously the electricity savings for homes and businesses that would install solar, all compared to the cost up to 1.33% on a typical electric utility bill. And the bottom line is at the bottom of the slide that every dollar in incentives, that production-based incentive, buys about $5 in economic activity. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we are happy to answer, as you suggested, any technical questions or clarifying questions about the substance of the bill before we hear from testifiers. Just maybe to set the table for that, those technical or clarifying questions, as I see it, there are four big pieces to this bill. There's the standard itself, the 10% by 2030 solar standard that ramps up. There's the value of solar calculation that helps assess set that market value for the solar energy production. There's the production incentive, which is there to help get people into the market to be able to afford to install this on the residential or business roofs. And then, of course, there is the surcharge to pay for the incentive, that up to 1.33%. Of course, there may be other questions, too, but I really see those as the four big pieces of this bill. So with that, we'll answer questions.
Any questions from members at this point before we go into the testimony? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I was kind of looking for a subdivision and section walkthrough of the bill. Are we just going to do that at a future time so we can get through more testimony today? Is that the plan?
Representative Garofalo, yeah, I think that that makes sense to do in the future when we're looking at the committee bill.
Okay. May I ask a question of Mr. Farrell then? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for your testimony, sir. In your document you hand out here, and I got it somewhere, you talk about this, but the price of solar. I want to ask you, how does this compare with the cost of other sources of clean energy, such as wind or efficiency? How does this cost compare to those?
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo. It would be difficult because the question is actually a kind of a comparison of apples and oranges. The way that this value of solar works is actually to look at the different methods or the different outputs that solar provides. For example, energy at peak time of demand when electricity is more expensive, or by generating close to load and avoiding transmission losses. And so it's really more of a valuation than a cost. And so in that sense, what we're doing is asking utilities to make a calculation of what is it really worth to you when you get that energy at that particular time and at that particular location, rather than what does it cost to produce. And so in that sense, it isn't comparable to, for example, what it costs to generate from a wind turbine. That would actually be a separate kind of calculation. One could also ask a utility to say, what is the value of a kilowatt hour from a wind project? But it would be apples and oranges for me to say, to put this in comparison to, for example, the cost of a wind turbine.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier then. So your advice to this committee is that we should trust the utility's judgment on this bill.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. As you may notice in the line item on the value of solar, that subdivision, I'm trusting not only the utilities but the Public Utility Commission and the Division of Energy Resources at the Department of Commerce.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And so in terms of quantifying the cost for this, when this committee goes forward, is there a metric before we vote on the bill? We don't want to be Washington. We don't want to vote on the bill so then we can know what's in it. Is there a metric or is there an agreement between the utilities and the solar industry on what this would cost in terms of extra money into the system for ratepayers?
Mr. Farrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, thank you for your question. The best number I can give you is up to 1.33% of an electricity bill. The value of solar is designed to be a payment equal to the market value of the solar energy. So in that context, and it is my opinion, and I believe the opinion of some of the utilities with which we have discussed, that it is, in fact, not an additional cost, but merely a payment for what it is worth, and that it is the production-based incentive that is what should be the focus of your inquiry as to the cost of the program.
And Madam Chair, I neglected before, sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Groff.
I wanted to compliment you before I ask my questions on your prudence and sensibility in laying this bill over rather than voting on it today. I know that there is certainly a lot of institutional pressure right now to be going faster, farther, bigger, and I just want to compliment you on your decision to lay this over, to be prudent and to be sensible, and I forgot to make that statement when I asked my initial question. And then I have another question for Mr. Farrell. This will be my last one before other questions. And that is that the 1.33% allotment assessment, how is that different than a sales tax on energy?
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you for your question, Representative Garofalo. I don't know that... I guess I would say this. I am not a tax attorney or a tax expert, and so I do not know specifically in the utility system the difference between the way that a sales tax would be assessed on a utility bill and the way that this would be assessed. I know that in general, these kinds of assessments that have been used to pay for this in other states are on a per kilowatt hour basis on a utility bill, but I couldn't speak specifically to how that compares to a sales tax.
Representative Morgan.
If I could take a crack at this, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, as Mr. Farrell pointed out, Xcel ratepayers are looking at a 9% rate increase, just as ratepayers, utilities look for increases to pay for all kinds of investments they make in capital over time. Xcel is looking at a 9% for maintenance and repairs on current capital with no increase in capacity. This 1.33 up to 1.33% surcharge will pay for an increase in capacity of 10% in solar to have solar energy be 10% of our capacity. So, ratepayers, the people of Minnesota, are getting something for what they pay on this.
And Madam Chair, since Representative Morgan, just a quick question on that one. Then I really am done. I promise.
Okay, Representative Groflo.
Representative Morgan, the 1.33% assessment allotment fee. Tax, we won't get in that debate. How much would that yield to from ratepayers on an annual basis?
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Farrell tells me the calculation is about $75 million, and again, this 1.33% is going to pay the production incentive that will go back to ratepayers who do install these facilities on their homes, businesses, and so forth.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I follow a blog that William Glahn does. He's former Assistant Commissioner of Energy Security for our state, and he estimated that this mandate of the additional 10% solar would increase the cost. I think, and I don't have it in front of me, I want to say $2 billion, but I did all the math, and it's going to increase my home, which is about 2,000 square feet. It's going to 2,000 square feet is going to increase my utility bill about $22 a month. Now, that was before this 1.33. So my question, I guess, is what do you say in defense of that? Because to me, it's just going to pass down all these expenses to the ratepayers. So I'd have you take a crack at that, and then I have one other question.
Who would like to answer that? Mr. Farrell or Mr. Farrell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. An excellent question. I would prefer to look over Mr. Glahn's blog post to be able to do some comparison of his cost analysis. I would say that, as I have previously, that I believe that the value of solar component of this is representative of the utilities paying what it's worth to have solar energy on their system, and that in my opinion that does not constitute an additional cost, and that therefore the only cost additional to ratepayers from this legislation is the up to 1.33%. And so in my estimation, if you are, for example, an Xcel Energy customer, the cost of this legislation over the next 35 years will be less than the rate increase you just experienced.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that there's really adequate proof that that's going to be the case, but my other question is, you know, I've read some articles on what I'm going to call solar sludge, and when these panels are manufactured, there's a sludge that has to be hauled away and disposed of. I'm just wondering if you could address the expense of that and what we're doing in Minnesota, because I know we have a couple of solar manufacturers in the state, and what are they doing? What's the cost of getting rid of that sludge, and where is it going? Thank you.
Mr. Hinkle.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I should introduce myself again. Lynn Hinkle, Policy Director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. A good question. In point of fact, the production technologies of the original equipment manufacturers, the module manufacturers in our state, do not have or are not a part of those categories of production that you're citing that have those toxic wastes. Those are typically thin film manufacturers, and the two production facilities in our state are silica production facilities, which don't use those technologies for production.
Follow-up. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond a little to some of this commentary about costs, and I think it's really important to also consider some of the costs of the other forms of energy that you know are also on the grid and that you know are really important to consider. You know, what are the costs of you know increasing casks at Prairie Island? What are the costs of transporting those casks somewhere out west that we don't know where they'll ultimately be? You know, what are the costs of increased coal production or current coal production? I know I'm going to get Representative Beard excited about this, but you know, I think that, and maybe it's more of a question for Mr. Evans when he comes, but I think that the utility companies ought to be looking at the fact that you know we're moving into an era where if there's not a carbon tax, eventually there's going to be some kind of system that's going to add costs to that production, and so. I think, members, when we talk about this issue, we also have to consider a lot of the externalities with some of these other forms of energy. And so we can focus on the sludge related to solar, but I think there's a lot more expensive and hazardous materials related to nuclear power. And certainly, I think coal presents all sorts of problems that, of course, we know are well documented. So just wanted to have the committee consider those costs as well when we're looking at solar.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Good points and a conversation we will have. Some members weren't able to be here when the committee started today, and so what we're trying to stick to at this point, we're clarifying in technical questions about the bill language. We're going to have a very full debate of an eventual committee bill that may or may not contain components of this bill. But if we are going to give members of the public who come here to testify an opportunity to inform us and share their perspective, that fuller discussion we really should postpone until later. And at this point, if anybody has any further technical or clarifying questions for the author and the presenters, let's go ahead with those. Or if not, we'll move into testimony. Okay. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll let the externalized cost go for another time. That will be a robust discussion that we will have about those things, because I think that it keeps coming up, and it does indeed reflect on this very issue that we're talking about today. Thank you for somebody who mentioned silica sand, I think. That's a major prominent thing, and I like silica sand. It makes glass, and we do all kinds of useful things with glass. So I just want to acknowledge that, too. But to the testifiers who are coming up, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I was a little late. I missed a couple things here. But, you know, we're talking about this surcharge that will pay the production incentive going forward. But there's just this nagging thought in the back of my mind that we're missing something here, that something's not being accounted for. So to other testifiers who are coming here, if you can talk about the incentive payments for installation. We actually, there's programs that pay for a portion of the cost to buy down the capital costs. That would be something for us to consider. Perhaps we should have a discussion, too, about the backup power and who gets to put that on their asset base and recover for that and so on and so forth. Like some things have been said that are important for us to know, but I think there's more to the story. And I'm sorry, I need another cup of coffee to jog my memory to remember what parts it is that we're missing in this important discussion. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Does anybody want to address whether there are costs outside the 1.33%, or should we... We'll move forward with the testimony at this point. Representative Quam, you have a quick question.
Yes, I also have some concerns with the 20-year contract time frame. So if testifiers can enlighten us in what systems may have been in Minnesota through our environment to be able to, you know, support long-range viability, and then I look forward to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Plum. We're going to start with Dustin Dennison from Applied Energy Innovations. And if you can keep it to 5 minutes or less, would be wonderful. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to briefly touch base at the end of my statements here about the two concerns that were brought up, longevity of the product, and also some more of the culture of the rebates. My name is Dustin Dennison, principal with Applied Energy Innovations. I'm a contractor, I'm a solar developer, and more importantly, I'm an employer of those looking for work. 4 years ago, I completed a 12-month stint of unemployment as a sheet metal worker in the commercial trades. I was one of tens of thousands of unemployed workers in the state, and we still have that problem. I took a leap of faith. 4 years ago, I launched a company focusing on renewables, energy, and energy efficiency. Over the past 4 years, we've hired 16 employees. We've contracted with 8 subcontractors. We work with 12 distributors, 7 manufacturers, participated in 3 bulk buy solar programs, 3 years of Excel rebates, 12 months of state rebates, and we recently doubled our office size in South Minneapolis. And we do install locally made Minnesota products, and we support a culture and an industry that right here provides local jobs and puts money directly back into the community. You may ask, why is that important? Because my business, like the dozens of other businesses that are here today, are building a viable industry driven on an ever-growing marketplace. Solar is an efficient, viable technology, and it needs a mechanism such as the Solar Energy Jobs Act, which I am asking you to please support and endorse. We need to keep Minnesota on a pathway to create clean jobs, to create jobs that are locally here in Minnesota. And that's why I'm here. That's what I'm talking about, is to support that culture and ask for your support in that. The question was asked about the longevity, the products, the installations that we do. We have 2 great manufacturers here in the state. Actually, we have many manufacturers in the state producing solar products and solar technology. We have one in particular that is boasting a longevity time of somewhere upwards towards 40 years in production. In the last 5 years, this technology has been refined. It has been executed to a level of expected production in capacity and both in guarantees in terms of what will it produce over 10 years, over 20 years, over 25 years. We have those numbers. And those numbers of production is what we guarantee, what we give to our customers and our clients, because we know this is what they're going to produce. And we know externally the benefits of that installation are going to trickle down into both the grid, literally, and the economy. Back to that culture, the rebates that we've existed on, there has been substantial programs to boost this industry and to get it off the ground. And I believe we're at a turning point. We have to decide where we want to get our energy from and what the cost of that is going to be. Is it going to be coal? Is it going to be nuclear? Is it going to be clean energy, such as solar or wind? We have to decide what the consequences of investing in those technologies and the impacts that all of those have on the environment. And I am convinced for my family, for the next generation, that we must have better options other than what we have for coal and nuclear, and then we have options that are going to be around and leave a lasting impact for the next generation, and that's the generation I speak of, my kids, and the environment that I expect and want them to live in. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Dennison? Representative Beard.
Just to be clear, Madam Chair, I have kids and grandkids, and within 10 years might even have great-grandchildren. And I'm very interested in our energy future, too. I just wanted to get that on the table. Thanks.
Thank you. The next testifier is the team of Deb Bergen from Missouri River Energy Services and Bill Black from Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association.
Good Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Bill Black from the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. And with me to answer any questions if you may have after my testimony are Larry Johnston from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency and Deb Bergen from Missouri River Energy Services. I've got three portions of the bill that I'd like to generally make some comments on, and I'll try to do it as efficiently as possible for you. The value of solar portion of the bill, I'd like to talk about the effects of this on the local control of municipal utilities, for one thing. Having a city-owned utility allows each community to provide local control of its power future through local accountability of the utility to its customers and owners. State law has recognized this over the entire past century. Municipal utilities are the ultimate community-based energy providers. As they have worked to integrate renewable technologies, they have been given the flexibility to select those technologies based on cost and operational capabilities. Many of the concepts in the proposal were developed not in Minnesota by Minnesota Utilities, but by the Municipal Utility of Austin, Texas. Austin developed its customized formula to achieve its goals its way. There are many reasons why what works for a large utility like Austin, Texas, may not be the best solution for a much smaller utility in Minnesota. The size of systems and the size of facilities are major factors for systems with fewer customers. This is a serious concern for municipal utilities. As to the formula itself, the details of the formula that will determine the value of solar for every utility in the state are not in this bill. There is a great risk of the proposed process combining the true value of solar to each system with a subsidy that some people believe ought to be part of that calculation. And that subsidy would be on top of the REPI payment, which is a conversation we think should be had separately from actually ascertaining the true value of solar. We are intrigued by the idea of the buy-all, sell-all, and value of solar model. However, we have serious doubts about the ability of municipal utilities to affect the outcome of the formula discussion under this proposal. We want to make sure it's a process that is not thwarted by special interests or that results in an overly simplistic formula that doesn't reflect what the true value and the true costs of solar are. We don't have any real sense of what the proposed formula factors really mean, which makes it impossible for us to evaluate the proposal. Finding the true value of solar for each utility should be done objectively. Both generators and customers should be treated fairly. If, after the process proceeds to determine the proper formula for the true value of solar, the value is not sufficient to incentivize the degree of solar penetration that the state believes is necessary, then a discussion about the proper amount of a subsidy should follow, independent from the finding of the true value point. Now, on the solar RES portion of the bill, we'd like to say that we have an aggressive renewable energy standard in place right now. We're halfway to our goal of 25% in 2025, and we may have done the easier half of that already. Flexibility was built into the agreement with utilities and Minnesota's energy customers that led to adoption of the RES. The existing RES allows the industry to propel expansion of the state's renewable industry to a degree that can be incorporated and can be flexible and allow for consideration of cost effectiveness. The solar RES in this proposal does not qualify in either of those counts. With a flexible RES in place, like the one we have, picking a specific technology to mandate means forcing utilities to invest in an energy source that is almost certainly not the least cost renewable resource. And you have in your packets a diagram that I brought that was produced by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory for the U.S. Department of Energy, and it shows Minnesota in comparison with the rest of the nation. And I'd like to just point out Minnesota and have you compare them us to states that have been compared to Minnesota by other folks, including California, Arizona, and Florida. You'll see that Minnesota is much more like Ohio, Pennsylvania, New England, New York, and nothing like Florida at all. And here we have a proposal for a 5% or a 10% renewable energy standard for solar. And as one of the presenters earlier mentioned, 5% is the highest solar RES in the country, and that is Arizona. States, including Arizona, also give greater credit toward their renewable energy standard for solar energy. So why, I would ask, would Minnesota enact a higher solar mandate than these states? And on the final point about the studies portion of the bill, it would be very impractical for utilities to suggest all the places where their systems could interconnect solar facilities. Well, there's a lot more detail to that, but I'll keep it short for purposes and then stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions from members? Sure. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just repeat the question I asked for the earlier testifier. How does the cost of solar compare, in your opinion, for your organization, how does the cost of solar compare to the cost of other clean energy, such as wind or an energy efficiency programs?
Mr. Black or Ms. Bergen?
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, I will defer to Ms. Bergen on that.
Yes, Representative Garofalo. One of the main components of cost isn't just the installation cost, it's the efficiency of the product that you're installing. In Minnesota, wind is roughly 30 to 40% capacity factor. So over a course of a year, 8,760 hours, we get much more out of a wind turbine than we get out of solar. Solar, in comparison, is 15% capacity factor. So if we were to put in 1% of the RES with wind versus 1% with solar, we would be putting in less wind than solar, because wind is more efficient in this area of the country. And therefore, from that standpoint, the cost would be less. Also, the installed cost, I know recently Xcel Energy did a 2-megawatt project. I believe their installed costs were around $4,500 a kilowatt, and wind is running us around $1,600 to $1,800 a kilowatt. So from a straight installation cost, wind is less expensive. And again, efficiency is key. There's a reason why there is no installed wind capacity in Florida. Their wind regime, their capacity is horrible. However, in Minnesota, we're over 4,000 megawatts. Why? Because we have a good capacity factor. So that must be considered when you look at costs.
Thank you.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the graph of the solar resource, one thing that's not taken into account in this graph is that the peak electrical demand, the peak seasonal electrical demand in Minnesota is during our air conditioning season in the summer. And this graph, since it says it's an annual average, doesn't take that into account in any way. Do you have comparable data that would allow us to compare how Minnesota compares to those other states during the summer?
I don't have hand.
Madam Chair, no, I'm afraid we don't.
Representative Yaruso, follow-up? No. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can, having lived a couple years in Arizona, guarantee that peak energy usage when it's 110 at 10 o'clock at night, that there would, our electric bills were much higher in the summer. But I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering, everything taken into account with this is, so with the hit to the green areas and the Great Lakes, is part of that, besides, it's farther north, but is part of that due to frost, dew, snow, and other precipitation that we have that they might not have in the southwest?
Mr. Black or Mr. Johnston?
Have any information on that at this point in time. That's something we could try to pull out for you.
Just as a matter of technicality, will you introduce yourself and say who you're with for the tape?
Yeah. I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power.
Thank you. And Ms. Bergen, I forgot to have you say who you're with for
yes,
the tape also.
Deborah Bergen, Missouri River Energy Services.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I think that there was some comment about how we have a subpar solar resource in the state of Minnesota, and if I could ask a question, what powers our agricultural industry? What source of energy?
Ms. Bergen.
Yes. Chairman Hartman, Representative Falk. Yes, granted, sun does have something to do with our agricultural industry. However, I was talking about efficiency.
I'm sorry, Mr. Madam Chair. I actually was directed to the
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Ms. Bergen.
No,
Mr. Black?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Black.
Representative Falk. I would imagine you're talking about solar energy, Representative Falk. That's all I know about agriculture. The sun grows the crops. That's
follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to put the point out there that we have a fairly strong agriculture industry that is pretty much run on the sun, so I think we can figure this out.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify the point about the difference between the summer and the winter. Because Minnesota is at a greater latitude than Florida or Texas or Arizona, we have a greater variation in our length of the day. Mm-hmm. And so we have a much greater length of time with sunlight during the summer than we do in the winter. Thank you.
This is the reason I won't ever travel during the month of June as a Minnesotan. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just an observation for the committee's consideration. This is actually put out by the National Renewable Energy Laboratories. They're very fond of renewable energy sources, have been since the 1970s. So I would have a hunch that this map of photovoltaic resources probably puts the best possible spin on everything that would have to do with solar. This was not put out by the electric companies or by anybody else. It was put out by the National Renewable Energy Lab. I imagine they took into account cloudy days and length of days and so on and so forth. And just to the comment on the solar being part of the agricultural business, it drives something called photosynthesis, people. We'd all be dead if we didn't have photosynthesis on this earth. Photosynthesis is a marvelous CO2 conversion device, actually. So it's not just the sun that drives photosynthesis. It's actually carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we've seen that over the last 30 or 40 years, where surveys that are taken from the Landsat satellites have actually shown an increase in vegetation growth around the world because of increased CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's not just sunlight. It's actually CO2 that makes human life possible on the face of the earth. Now I actually have a question for the testifiers, but while I'm on the waiting list, I keep hearing all these marvelous things to comment on, Madam Chair, and they're important things for us to consider. If we did achieve this, and I don't know, Mr. Black, I know you're the municipal guy, and I represent Shakopee, and we've got about 100 megawatt an hour daily load in Shakopee because we're an industrial town. We build things. We convert a lot of sand into glass, for instance, in Shakopee, so that we can make useful things happen. But if we achieve this mandate of 10.6 or whatever the mandate is, can you imagine that we could actually dismantle then some of our baseload power because we would have solar energy on the grid? Because, you know, the CertainTeed plant and the shingle plant and the box plant and the glass plant run 24 hours a day, not to mention the malt plant and everything else we do out there, a casino or two and a race track and so on. So if we did actually accomplish this, could we actually dial back our baseload power, do you think?
Mr. Black.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I think you make an excellent point that the power is not available all the time when we need consistent power throughout the day and the night.
Madam Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you for letting me make the point. Because, members, what we have is we have capital that's tied up in three forms. It's actually doing a pretty phenomenal job of making us prosperous, keeping the lights on when the sun's not shining, keeping it warm when it's cold, because February is actually getting close to being the peak month for electrical demand in this state, folks. February, shortest days of the year, coldest days of the year. But members, we've got cash tied up in the form of stockholders investing. We've got land tied up in the form of power plants, transmission lines, and substations being built. And we have labor being tied up producing all this useful stuff, adding value to the coal and the uranium and the natural gas that we buy from other places. It just doesn't come here and sit in a pile. We have built factories that convert this into something useful for our economy. And it's all sitting there accomplishing the job. And what we're doing is we're telling people who have invested in land, in labor, and in cash to stand down your stuff while we make up a new standard that we want you to buy that doesn't have to exist in the marketplace. So for the gentleman who wanted a viable industry to be created, I'm sorry, we already have a viable industry. I just want to be very clear to this committee that what we're asking is for people that are doing viable and useful work in a cost-effective and efficient manner to stand their equipment and their labor down and do something else with it. That's kind of what we're up to here, Madam Chair. So no, there will be no power power towers taken down, no substations dismantled. This will be layered on top of something's already working.
With all due respect, Representative Beard, I think what we're talking about is what we might want the future to look like in terms of capital deployment and jobs. And I think we should be careful when we talk about our opinions in favor of or against a bill to put words in the mouths of the proponents of what they want or what they don't want, and try as hard as we can just to stick to the substance. I do respect your point of view, but I think we don't want to go to the point where we say the proponents want to idle something or want to put something on the sidelines. Unless they say that themselves, I think it's better if we don't go in that direction. Let's move to the next testifier, Nathan Franzen from Geronimo.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Nathan Franzen. I'm the Director of Solar for Geronimo Energy. We're an Edina-based wind and solar developer. We focus on commercial and utility-scale projects. I've been in the solar industry for the past 5 years and have worked on over 100 projects across 17 states and currently own and operate over a megawatt of solar in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify that it is now time to act on solar legislation in Minnesota. Prices have continued to fall and have brought solar in line with the value of energy it offsets in the marketplace. In 2009, the St. John Solar Farm was installed for a cost of $7 a watt. Today, that same system can be installed for around $2 a watt, a 70% drop in installed cost in just 4 years. When we combine this dramatic decline in installed costs with the fact that solar energy offsets new peaking capacity investments while also producing valuable on-peak energy, you can start to see why the economics of solar are changing so rapidly. This point is illustrated by the fact that in some other states, we are regularly seeing solar compete and win in open source RFPs against other forms of new peaking generators such as natural gas. In Minnesota, the blended energy and capacity rate in 2011, as reported by FERC, for two of our peaking facilities was in excess of $250 a megawatt hour. Solar can displace this high-priced energy and capacity. Passing comprehensive solar legislation now will allow us to lock in Minnesota jobs before they take root in other areas of the country, and take advantage of the favorable tax code before changes take effect in 2016. Fortunately, Minnesota has a successful model it can replicate. The solar industry is in roughly the same place the wind industry was in the late 1990s when Minnesota took a step to become a national leader in the wind industry with the enactment of the renewable standards. Therefore, we support a reasonable solar standard that targets acquiring projects at the lowest installed cost and supports all three unique market segments, namely the residential, commercial, and utility scale solar markets. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with the committee on this and other related bills. Thank you.
Questions from members?
Madam Chair, just a quick question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if the cost is competitive with wind and other, why carve out specifically for solar and not make a statement or drive for a general renewable, increasing that percentage? If it's going to be cost-driven and you're superior, then why wouldn't you just win in merits and, allow for the, market to drive which renewable we go for?
Mr. Franzen.
Madam Chair, I think my response to that would be we're looking for a market signal to encourage Minnesota to be a leader in the industry, and that is why we're in favor of a solar standard and the solar value of solar rate.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you might be able to answer this question, maybe one of the later testifiers. I'm very interested in understanding what large-scale solar installation, when was the first date, you know, how long is the longest large-scale solar installation been in Minnesota? And then do we have any data as to any efficiency or annual maintenance upkeep expenses across that to be able to extrapolate, you know, a 20-year, you know, cost or efficiency of such a system?
Mr. Franzen.
Madam Chair and Representative, I can tell you that I installed the first larger system, which was the St. John's Solar Farm, back in 2009. It has been operating nearly exactly as it was predicted to perform based on the radiance. And I can tell you that the industry as a whole has reached a point where we are able to finance large projects through all five major banks that purchase tax equity. And we're able to do so based on engineering and science on predictability. The fact that systems are getting larger doesn't negate the fact that we've had solar systems installed and operating for decades, and those same systems can provide us data. And so really when we're making systems larger, we're able to capitalize on the modularity of, you know, basically making solar much bigger without having with having that data from the past two decades. So it's very easy for us to extrapolate and predict exactly what's going to happen. The banks have recognized this, the insurance companies have recognized this, and that is why you're seeing such an explosion in the market.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we have data out there for decades, it'd be nice if the committee could, for further examination, have data from several sources in the efficiency and the maintenance and durability of the systems just referenced. I would not anticipate it being present today, but I definitely would anticipate it being present before we, you know, consider actual bill for passage.
Mr. Franzen, could you provide us with some more detailed information on the performance of the St. John systems, or the cost and the generation and the maintenance?
Certainly.
Expenses? Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony, sir. Two quick questions. One, you mentioned $250 for a megawatt hour during peak from peaking power sources. Can you share with the committee the frequency of that? Is that in the MISO market?
Mr. Franzen.
That was based on two peaking plants within Minnesota as their data reported to FERC. So it's taking their cost of energy divided by their megawatt hours provided to the system, and that's the cost.
Representative Garofalo.
So say that again. The cost of energy divided by what?
So total energy produced, but, you know, by the total cost.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Just to be clear then, so if we did not have a hot summer, if usage was low and the peak power plant is not being used, that's what you're taking the capital costs and attributing it to, just the fact that it's not being used.
Madam Chair, what I'm referring to is a blended rate to illustrate the point that we're paying for both capacity and energy on peaking plants, and that solar provides both capacity and energy. Certainly we'll never completely eliminate peaking plants. I acknowledge that. But my point is to acknowledge that solar provides both capacity and energy, and can help to avoid additional new peaking facilities being added to the system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And again, thank you for your testimony. Perhaps rather than us crowding out other testifiers, if you could maybe just supply the committee with sort of the explaining the $250 number and citing the sources from FERC, that would be very helpful. My final question is with regards to, you mentioned both, all three, you mentioned residential solar, commercial solar, and utility solar. From a cost and benefit perspective, please explain to me how residential and utility-based solar are similar. It would seem that obviously a large-scale operation would have significant cost savings and benefits.
Mr. Franzen.
Madam Chair, there are different benefits provided by different market segments. Obviously, utility-scale solar has the lowest installed cost. There are other benefits due to the location of the grid, and being able to produce energy directly at the load provides additional benefit to residential and commercial solar. So there are different and attributable benefits to both.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
And Mr. Franzen, just so from your expert opinion, utility scale solar and residential solar, you would view those as on par with neither preference for either one?
Mr. Franzen.
Madam Chair, well, I represent a company that develops commercial and utility scale systems, so by that nature, I am biased. But
hence the question. Thank you very much.
All right. Our next testifier is Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are an organization of about 2,400 large and small businesses. Actually, 80% of our membership are small businesses across the state of Minnesota. I'd like to thank you for having me speak today to the committee. And I think I'm the first ratepayer representative to come before the committee today. So I take that, that position very seriously. I'd like to start out first by making this point, the chamber is not opposed to renewable generation or distributed generation. Actually, in fact, and I think Nathan's organization might have been a part of it, at the Public Utilities Commission, we represented a group of ratepayers that wanted a fair solar rate from Xcel, and we actually worked with Xcel to try to get their concerns acknowledged. So we do have a history of representing and making sure that those customers are treated equitably and fairly in the system. But I'd also like to mention that we've adopted a policy and we remain firm that other customers shouldn't be forced to pay for the decisions of another customer. So, I think a representative example would be the 1 megawatt solar array that IKEA put up, and they invested their own money in it. I think they're too big to get net metering, so they were actually forced to negotiate a rate privately with Xcel. I think what's frustrating in this debate, there's nothing in the law that's prohibiting people from putting up distributed generation systems on their house or on their property. I think the biggest what we have heard, though, is that people think that it's too expensive. Well, I think you could draw the same analogy. I'm not a snowmobiler, but I know Polaris makes a lot of snowmobiles here. And so by the government paying for snowmobiles, you're going to create jobs. You're going to have the Polaris factory working. But that doesn't mean the taxpayer should be on the hook. And I think we need to also think about ratepayers as taxpayers. And I think Representative Beard made a good point that, and Representative Groflo, this is essentially a tax. The way the bill is structured is a tax on the ratepayer. But I think what's important as well is to look at rates. The Midwest, especially our region, has had historically low electric rates. But unfortunately, our rates in Minnesota are rising much faster than our surrounding states. And that's concerning from the Chamber's perspective, most importantly because we're home to a lot of energy-intensive industries. You think about mining, paper, some of those historic industries that we've had in this state that consume, in some cases, up to 25% of their costs of doing business are their energy costs. In 1990, Minnesota ranked 12th in commercial rates, and as of 2011, we are now 18th lowest, so we've fallen six spots there. Our industrial rates were number 15 in the country in 1990, and in 2011, we were 25th. And that's pretty scary numbers for the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, these are jobs, and I think you hear the proponents of this bill saying they're going to create jobs. And I know at the Capitol, having spent some time here, we talk a lot about job creation, but I think we also need to focus on job retention. And when you start raising rates, and I know you see here that 97% of DFL, 86% of independent, and 89% of GOP residents would be willing to pay $2 more per month for solar power. You know, and that's great, but when they actually get the bills, I think you see a different result. And I think there's some utilities that are scheduled to testify, and a lot of them have optional renewable programs. And I challenge you to ask them what their membership in those are, and how, because I believe the last time I heard, some of them have remained flat. So this idea that people want it and are willing to pay for it, well, they already can, and they're not. And so I would dispute that. And I'd also challenge you to talk to your businesses and ask them if they can afford to pay these higher bills. You know, one of the things when I visit with businesses around the state, they can't pass on the cost of energy to the customer. There's this mistaken belief around the Capitol that businesses can just pass on the cost. And when you're operating in a global marketplace like a lot of our industries in Minnesota do, They're paying a commodity price. They don't get to decide that price. And so as the cost of that energy rises, they're either forced to cut workers or not invest in their plants. And, I mean, you can look around and see in the metro area as well as in the rural areas of Minnesota, we've lost a lot of those businesses. And I understand that people want jobs in the solar industry, but there's a lot of jobs where people are currently working, and they want to keep those. And I think it's important that we think about that. Thank you.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gerber, just maybe it's more of a microcosm of one utility, but does the chamber have a position on whether or not they would rather pay for, say, like a 9.8% increase of Xcel rate fares and get no increase in capacity, or a 1.3% increase and actually get a 10% increase in capacity? Do you have a position on that?
Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Falk. We actually do. Part of my job is to represent the Chamber of Commerce of the Public Utilities Commission. And so with all due respect to Xcel, who I know is here, I mean, we do fight them on that. And we have a group of customers, and we challenge them on the prudency of all their investments. But I'd also challenge you to look at the rate case. There is an increase in capacity in some respects. So I think Representative Morgan may have mistakenly said that there wasn't. And there is in this upcoming rate case. They are increasing capacity. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask, what are the costs, if once you've installed a solar facility, what are the costs to run it? What are the long-term costs to it?
Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I think that'd be a good question for Nathan from Geronimo. I haven't run that, but I know that I can speak to the costs are much higher per kilowatt hour than some other forms of energy to install it.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question was about the operational costs. I know that with kind of fossil fuel forms of energy, or if you want to talk about nuclear, it's you've got actually the fuel cost, which I think oftentimes is forgotten. So it's almost more important to look at this as an investment, because you're making that investment up front, and then really there is no fuel cost to it. Now, granted, we can talk about the issues regarding additional generation for peaking or storage. We haven't even begun to talk about storage or what the opportunities or abilities are there. But I always hear that let's debate the upfront cost, what's the cost right now, but we never talk about the long-term cost. And I think your organization should be very concerned about the long-term cost, because if we look at the rate increases that occurred over the last couple of years, it's been almost entirely driven by diesel fuel surcharge adjustments, because you have to be able to get the coal to the coal plant by one means or another, and it's typically rail. And those fuel surcharges get passed right along to the ratepayers. And I don't see an organization like the Chamber of Commerce getting up and often talking about things like that. And I think that should be part of the discussion.
Members, we have 9 more testifiers, and we have 45 more minutes of committee. So we do want to give our testifiers 5 minutes each. We have to be a little bit more brief ourselves. Representative Hornstein.
Very quick question along the lines of Representative Falk. You mentioned this is a taxpayer expense. So I don't know if the Chamber in Minnesota or the United States Chamber of Commerce has concerns or taken a position for or against the $100 billion of subsidy that goes to the oil industry. That's a tax expenditure, too. So I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah. Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair, can I respond briefly to Representative Falk? We do actually get involved in as well as in the fuel clause adjustment issues, and we are concerned about the over-reliance potentially on natural gas, and we are worried about that. Representative Hornstein, thank you for the question. I think, there's a great article that I think appeared in Forbes, and I can send it to you, and it's about why even liberals love oil subsidies. And actually, one of the largest subsidies is LIHEAP, which is the Low-Income Heating Assistance Program, because it creates an artificial demand for more heating. So I think that's the second largest after the largest are actually tax incentives that all other companies get. So, I mean, I understand your question. I mean, but and President Obama did cut LIHEAP by 50% too. So, I think if you're worried about those, we can have a discussion about that as well.
I can't wait till we have the hearing on the National Energy Plan. But for right now, we're talking about a solar bill. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually happen to have a copy of that article right here, if Representative Hornstein would like to see it. But The largest expenditure that the oil companies use is for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is designed to protect our U.S. Oil shortages. So $2.5 billion of those oil subsidies out of the $4 billion a year are in subsidies either for low and reduced, you know, reduced energy, the petroleum reserve, and second largest category is $1 billion in tax exemption for farm fuel, because farmers don't pay energy tax. So thank you.
The next testifier is Pete Paris from the Sheet Metal Workers.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Pete Paris. I'm with the Sheet Metal Workers Union. We also belong with the Blue-Green Alliance and also the Energy Jobs Association, which both of those organizations, along with the sheet metal workers, always look at trying to save energy and to create jobs at the same time. So we are very much in favor of this bill, especially with as much unemployment as there is right now in the building trades. Things have gotten better, but we're still probably all looking at anywhere between 18 to 25% unemployed, so there is capacity to keep on working. My brother, Dustin, that started his own company, was once a sheet metal worker, had to venture out on his own. We don't like to lose good mechanics like that. We want to maintain them, and all of us in the building trades like to maintain the people that we have and keep on growing our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Pete, for Mr. Paris? No. Okay, our next testifier, thank you very much for your testimony. Our next testifier is Rick Evans from Xcel Energy. Should have given you more of a heads up since you're a little further away from the table. Now the clock starts now. Go ahead.
I didn't hear that remark, but so I won't respond, whatever it was.
He Madam thought we Chair, should ding you for taking time to walk down to the table. And I
well,
said,
you mixed up your agenda, so I didn't know if I was next or not. I didn't want to waste the steps. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. I'm going to be brief. I could spend a lot of time, and other people from our company could come and spend a lot of time talking about elements of this bill, and I understand the time is short, and we will take that opportunity as the process moves along. I want to point out that we have participated in the stakeholder meetings with the Department of Commerce on the issue of solar energy for about the last 18 months. They've been productive and good meetings. I'll also point out that we are members of MNSEA, Mr. Hinkle's organization. I think we missed the day that they voted on this bill, but we continue to be a member in good standing of that organization. And out of those stakeholder meetings that we participated in, there have been brought some good ideas, and some of those ideas show up in this bill, and I want to make note of those. The buy-all, sell-all program to replace net metering, we think, is a really good direction, and it's contained in this bill. This bill gives customers the option of choosing net metering versus buy all, sell all. We think that's a mistake. We'd like to work on that and convince the proponents that we should move to the buy all, sell all program as the way to go forward with distributed generation. And so we're grateful to the author for putting that in the bill, and would like to work to continue developing that. We also think that the value of solar is a good concept. When you do a buy-all, sell-all, that means the utility is going to sell the customer all of their energy, and we're going to buy all of the energy off of their generation source. And the trick, of course, is deciding, well, what's that price going to be? It's not really practical for us to go to every homeowner who puts an energy generation source in their home and negotiate a power purchase agreement with them. And so we need to find a means to set a price that we're going to pay for that energy coming off of that off of that system. And we think that the value of solar is a good way to do that. We do think that this bill contains some elements in their value of solar that are not appropriate for the value of solar. They ought to be reflected more in the subsidy that is paid to customers rather than in the value of solar. But we look forward to continuing our conversations with the proponents and the author to see if we can make some progress on that. The other thing we like about the bill is that it separates. By using the value of solar, if we can get to what we consider to be the real value of solar, it separates the value that we pay for the energy, which is truly its value, from the subsidy. And that's really important. That's the reason to move away from net metering and some of these other devices, because it should be clear to policymakers how much of the price being paid for this energy is really the value and how much of it is a subsidy. That's important for a bunch of reasons, but one of the reasons is that if certain kinds of generation are going to get cheaper, as everyone expects, it's important to identify what the subsidy is so that it can be adjusted accordingly. One of the things I'll mention about the bill is, though it leaves the spaces blank, it does seem to try to set up the amount of the subsidy in statute, which we think is a mistake. You shouldn't have to come back to the legislature every time the value, or rather the price of some generation resource changes. We should have a mechanism by which that'll be adjusted through a regulatory process and not by having to come back to the legislature. We do recognize the value of subsidies. If you're going to have solar energy in today's market, you're going to have to pay a subsidy. There's no getting around it. Nobody is going to put, or very few people, I should say, are going to put this stuff up if they don't get paid a subsidy for doing it, because the value of solar to our company is simply not enough to give anyone incentive to do it. We've recognized that when 4 years ago Xcel Energy launched its solar rewards program, where we pay an upfront subsidy, and then 2 years later when we added the Minnesota bonus program, which pays an upfront subsidy for Minnesota-made products. But those two programs, we think, need to be reformed, need to be changed, and so we look forward to working through this bill to see if we can get the subsidies right as we move forward. Having said all that, we do have a lot of concerns with the bill. And the primary concern that we have with the bill is, frankly, the price. It's the cost. The cost of this bill is pretty large. We think $75 to $80 million will be raised annually to pay for solar, and yet solar is still a very expensive resource. And what we'd ask the policymakers to think about is, what are we trying to accomplish here? Frankly, we came into this legislative session thinking we were trying to accomplish carbon reduction. Solar is a very expensive way to achieve carbon reduction. Now I understand this bill is actually to create jobs, and that's important too, and solar certainly will create jobs, but a lot of things will create jobs, and I think solar is a very expensive way to create jobs. Wind creates jobs, wind reduces carbon, and it does it at about 10 times lower price than what we would end up paying for solar. Conservation programs create jobs, conservation programs reduce carbon, and they do it at about a tenth of the price, less than a tenth of the price of doing it through solar. This is not to say that we shouldn't do solar. It's to say that we should be careful as we balance the different choices that we have in terms of renewable energy and clean energy resources, including conservation, as we move forward. And we think that this bill gets the balance wrong. By way of an example, back in 1994, the state of Minnesota started two experiments. One was with wind energy, and one was with biomass energy. They were small, they were modest, they were our first toe in the water towards these new energy technologies. In the last 20 years, what we found is that wind was a relative success. In many cases, wind does come in as a low-cost resource for us, and we've been able to integrate wind into our system in a way that actually makes financial sense for our customers. On the other hand, biomass turned out to be not such a good experiment in a way that actually makes financial sense for our customers. On the other hand, biomass turned out to be not such a good experience. It was very expensive 20 years ago, and it's very expensive today. We have never added a biomass facility beyond what was mandated in 1994. The market has never demanded that we do so, and the legislature has never demanded that we do so, because, though in 1994 we thought it would become a cheap resource, turns out, by 2013, not so cheap. It's still a very expensive resource. And so as we proceed working on this bill, and we do look forward very much to working on this bill and the other bills that are going to come along dealing with renewable energy and conservation and solar, we think that that experience should be kept in mind. The biomass expense has not been a huge burden on our customers, and that was because it was modest, it was cautious. We worked our way along as the value of the resources developed. We found ourselves with a good resource in wind and a not-so-good resource in biomass. That's an important thing to keep in mind. The last thing I'll mention is in the governor's speech, State of the State speech, he challenged the legislature to bring all of the stakeholders together, including the utility companies, the environmental groups, the manufacturers, the developers, and all the other stakeholders in this effort to see if we can find a cautious, we would say, he didn't use those words, but a cautious, careful, modest way to move forward on this new resource without causing financial harm to our customers. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Evans? Thank you for your testimony. I do look forward to your participation in the conversation as we go forward. The next testifier we have is Jennifer Schaubach from the AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the Legislative Director at the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We are a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions, representing more than 300,000 working people throughout the state. I'm here to speak today mostly in favor of House File 773. The Minnesota AFL-CIO has always been strongly supportive of initiatives that create good family-supporting jobs. That's no secret. Passing House File 773, the Solar Energy Jobs Bill will create over 2,000 permanent jobs in just the first year and thousands over the life of the policy. These are good family-supporting jobs that range across skill, education, and income spectrum in many fields, including construction and installation, design and engineering, manufacturing materials, equipment and components, training solar professionals, and developing, marketing, and financing. We would also be building our solar capacity, bringing new business investment opportunities to our state, and reduce our reliance on imported energy. Something I did not know, which surprised me, is that Minnesota imports 85% of our electricity from other states and countries. To me, that just seems crazy. Our state spent $20 billion in total expenditures on energy sources imported from other states and countries. This just sends jobs and dollars out of Minnesota that we should be keeping here. We believe that the Made in Minnesota provisions in the bill are a critical component ensuring that our state's businesses benefit from new investments associated with expanding solar. Now, with that said, some of our affiliates have raised concerns. One, solar power for peak needs to be backed up by natural gas, coal, and or nuclear energy. We cannot eliminate these alternative sources of energy or the jobs associated with them. Percentage rates of generation may be too aggressive. Four, and lastly, during the recession, Minnesota lost thousands of manufacturing jobs. While our economy is rebounding, the jobs being created are much lower wage jobs. We would like to see language that ensures that if state or federal subsidies are used in the construction, permitting process, or maintenance of the project, prevailing wage and project labor agreements be applied. For efficient use of public dollars, we would encourage using union contractors. It is well known that union contractors build it right the first time and within or under budget. Regardless, prevailing wage should apply in the construction and maintenance of the project. There are conversations taking place to work on these concerns, and we look forward to working together to pass House File 773. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, the next, thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Joel Johnson from the Minnesota Rural Electric Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I'm with the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. To be honest, our members have some grave concerns over the legislation. We think it contains a number of bad policy choices. The way that it funds the expansion and incentives for solar is very regressive. And it ultimately will destroy as many jobs as it creates. I'll go through. We have five main objections to the bill. The first is the 10% solar energy standard. Not only does it renege on the negotiated principle contained in the 2007 renewable energy standard that utilities would be allowed to decide the best approach to meeting the renewable energy standard, it does so in an extremely expensive and inefficient way. And we think it's far more expensive than it's being characterized right now. Conservative back-of-the-envelope calculations that we've done indicated that it will cost Minnesotans $26 billion, or just a little bit under that, just for the cost of the solar panels and the installation. That comes to around $20,000 for a family of four. Great River Energy, which is the largest generation and transmission cooperative in the state, estimates that meeting the 1% requirement alone will cost its members $425 million in new capital outlays. That's assuming an average capacity factor of 15% and the installation of 85 megawatts of solar generation at an installation price of $5,000 a kilowatt. We also think that the 1.33% 80 million sales tax on electricity is a very regressive way to raise the money for incentives. Right now, there is the way the bill is written, it's unclear whether co-ops and municipals would be assessed that 1.33 tax. However, we've had indications from supporters of the bills that we are intended to be included. But we just think it's unfair, particularly for our low, middle, and fixed-income members, to be subsidizing the installation of solar panels on multi-million-dollar homes on Lake Minnetonka, Lake Calhoun, or even Gull Lake. And that's essentially where most of these installations are going to go. You need large upfront costs to get these, and that's most people don't have those kind of resources to do that. We're also concerned that there is no consumer or member protection in the bill. Mostly all of it is producer protection. It shifts most of the risks onto ratepayers, and it sends most of the benefits to individuals who can afford the upfront cost of solar. We also don't believe that it addresses the serious cost shifting issues with the state's current net metering laws. We've talked to most of you people on the members of the committee about this, about the amount of cost shifting that goes under the current net metering regime, and those are not addressed in this bill. And finally, our last concern is electric co-ops don't need more generation. We already have enough of it. Most of our members are not expecting to build any new generation for at least a decade, if not more. And forcing us to add costly new solar generation to our systems will in turn force us to dump even more of our excess wind onto the MISO market at a loss. Electric cooperatives are already losing over $70 million a year in those kind of transactions, and we simply don't need more of those kind of losses. Thank you. I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hoping to get an idea of some co-ops have almost all residential, others have industrial and a mix. And if solar was implemented, how would it, depending on your mix, have a cost burden different for some of your, co-op members and not others?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, typically the vast majority of our meters are residential meters, and we don't have the large industrial commercial loads that other types of utilities do. So the opportunities for commercial scale solar would be significantly less for cooperatives than it would for other utilities. So most of our opportunities would be residential.
Representative McClellan, first I want to just note for members, the committee hearing room smells like cigarette smoke right now because it must be nice enough outside for people to be taking a smoke break along the sides of the building. And for people who smoke, you might want to know that when you take a smoke break on either side of the building, it comes right into the air intake and right into the hearing rooms. So, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I was trying to bring out is that some of the unintended consequences of past legislation that, you know, was global is that efficiency and other targets are much more difficult for some of the co-ops and some of the different groups because they don't have the industrial or the different mix. And that if there's any way in the future that we do a change, that we take into account and allow for some mechanism to make it, you know, reasonable, you know, across the full mix, because something that's really efficient and effective for the metro may not work in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Quam, and I think the committee would love to see language proposed, you know, in future hearings in either bill form or in amendment form that would treat different generators differently and deal with the issues that you raised. Other questions for Mr. Johnson? Falk, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things to Mr. Johnson. I do take a little offense to the fact that all these installations would happen only in areas of perceived wealth. I think there's a number of people in rural parts of the state that are served by rural cooperatives that would like to have the option to go and install solar at their homes. So the idea that it only happens around Lake Calhoun or some of these other areas, I think that that's maybe mischaracterizing some of the intent that we have from a lot of our customers. I'm served by Rural Electric Service. I've been contacted many times by neighbors, constituents, people I know that want this option. I was going to ask beyond that point, you mentioned the $26 billion cost. I'm trying to work the math on this. This bill caps basically, you know, the rate at 1.33%, and if you extrapolate that $26 billion to 1.33% of sales, you'd have to have about $1.954 trillion worth of sales over the next 20 years that the cooperatives are supplying. I'm just trying to understand your numbers, because this $26 billion investment at 1.33% of sales means you have a huge amount of sales, which I don't think that you're there. So I'm trying to understand the methodology.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, that total is based on the 10% solar mandate, the standard. Total, the estimate of total use in Minnesota is 85 million megawatt hours in 2030. 10% of that would be 8.5 million megawatt hours. And that's what it's based on, those figures. And to reach that amount of electricity, you would need a total installed capacity of 6,489 megawatts, factoring a capacity factor of around 15%.
Representative Falk.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And what was your cost per kilowatt hour or kilowatt installed or megawatt installed?
In this one, it was $4 a watt.
Representative Falk.
Madam Chair, I think that, you know, at least according to some of the testimony we've heard, that seems like it might be a bit high, and we're expecting that as technology improves, kind of like in the wind industry, the cost of what you get for a megawatt hour of generation has fallen basically by half in the last decade. But irrespective of the 10%, I mean, the 1.33% cap here, you know, is supposed to provide some assurance, and I just think that the numbers that you're presenting, that I'm not arguing the methodology, so to say, but this cap, I think that doesn't necessarily line up with it. So I just urge some caution there.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, my good friend Representative Falk just point out the opportunity that his constituents would like the opportunity to have solar installed, and they want this flexibility. What statutory provisions do we have in law in Minnesota, or what policies do the co-ops have that stop individuals from putting in 40 kilowatt hour installations or less in your service territories?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are none.
Okay, so Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Okay, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, my friend Representative Falk, I think what he meant to say was is that his constituents or some people he know look forward to the opportunity to have someone else pay for their solar installations that they want to have, because certainly under current law and under policies that the co-ops and rural co-ops have, that they are allowed to put solar in. And, in fact, some are taking advantage of that.
Well, Representative Garofalo and Representative Falk and all members of the committee, I think it's better when we're having the conversation that we not characterize what another member is saying and we let the members' words speak for themselves. I think we have a variety of viewpoints and valid viewpoints and valid points to make, but I think the conversation will go better if we don't try to characterize each other's comments, and we just let them stand on their own. And Representative Falk.
And Madam Chair, you are right, and I accept Representative Falk's apology.
Representative Falk.
Well, Representative Garofalo has an inflated sense of self-worth at the moment.
But, and also, if we avoid personal comments, that'd be helpful.
I think what people want is they want to be paid the fair value, because right now, through our net metering statute, it doesn't account for the cost related to transmission. It doesn't account for the cost related to additional peaking plants. It doesn't account to the cost of fuel surge adjustments. And so basically, you are paid one of the lowest rates that does not account for any externalities. And so let's make the system more fair, because I think that's what people appreciate is fairness.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I may have misheard you when you were explaining your basis for coming up with that cost. You said that it would require 8.5 million megawatt hours of solar, and then by applying the 15% efficiency, what was that number you came up with at that point?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Russo, let me find the page where it's on again, or I could share it with her after the...
Well, I thought I heard you say, but this is where I may have misheard you because I have a terrible cold. 6,489 million megawatt hours. And if you take 15% of that, that would be 973, which would be 10 times as much as the total production in the state of Minnesota. So somehow something's off. I may have misheard.
We can do more detailed math questions offline. Do we have any more questions for this testifier? Otherwise, we have four more to get through before we end. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. We really appreciate your participation. Our next testifier is Christy Newell from the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christy Newell, and I'm the coordinator with the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network. We work with young people across the state, from Winona, Bemidji, Morris, and elsewhere, to build a resilient and sustainable future that offers opportunities for our generation. Today I am testifying in support of House File 773, the Solar Energy Jobs Act. In my job, I work with hundreds of youth who, like myself, are deeply concerned about the environment and how the decisions being made today impact our future. We know that climate change is real. Devastating droughts, fires, and increased temperatures are already disturbing our economy. The impacts are not only being felt in Minnesota, but globally. Myself, like many of the young people I work with, have devoted their higher education to studying the impacts and solutions to climate change. In fact, at the University of Minnesota, the Sustainability Studies Department has grown from 18 students 5 years ago to over 100 today. And this is part of a national trend. 5 years ago, there were around 200 higher education institutions in the U.S. who offered degree programs in sustainability studies, and today that number is roughly 2,000. I share this information to show that young people are studying and working toward building a green economy that must include renewable energy from solar. Our old technologies are not meeting our needs or our state's carbon reduction goals. Yesterday, I was here at the Capitol. I was with over 100 young people from across the state. They were with organizations like my own, the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, and the Youth Environmental Activists, a program of the Will Steger Foundation. We were here to meet with our legislators and to urge you to pass the Solar Energy Jobs Act. Implementing a solar standard of 10% by 2030 is critical is a critical next step that will utilize our technological and natural resources to mitigate climate change. Furthermore, it will offer employment opportunities for a generation that is disproportionately unemployed and underemployed. In Minnesota, we currently spend $20 billion annually on purchasing and importing energy from other states and nations. With the Solar Energy Jobs Act, Minnesota can utilize our untapped solar energy potential and create jobs here in our state. Solar energy is the technology that my generation wants. It is the energy source that we envision powering our homes, businesses, and schools. Today, I ask you to be the leaders that my generation so desperately needs and to pass the Solar Energy Jobs Act to support the emerging green economy and protect our future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Michael Noble from Fresh Energy.
Madam Chair, I'm Michael Noble, the Executive Director of Fresh Energy.
Ross Abbey, also with Fresh Energy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Michael Noble. I've come to this committee many times over the years. I know some of you quite well, and others I'm anxious to get to know. Fresh Energy enthusiastically supports the Solar Energy Jobs Act, looks forward to a Minnesota with 50,000 rooftops with solar energy on them. Applaud Representative Morgan for his visionary leadership helping to bring this bill to the committee. Members, the United States Department of Energy has a program that's exclusively focused on reducing the cost of solar. That goal of that program is to have the solar energy cost not $8 a watt or $4 a watt or $2 a watt. The goal of the United States Department of Energy is solar energy at $1 a watt. Yesterday, Stephen Chu, Secretary of Energy in the United States of America, said that solar energy would be the cheapest form of electricity worldwide. It would be cheaper than existing coal plants and existing natural gas plants approximately in 10 years by the year 2023. So members, really the purpose of this bill is to build an industry so that we're ready when solar energy is the cheapest form of energy worldwide. That's the purpose of the bill. We've heard people talk about building a viable industry. It's a small business industry that serves homeowners. It's a medium-sized business industry that serves small commercial interests. It's large electrical contractors, like this kind of electrical contractors that might get hired at, build the Viking Stadium to build large commercial solar energy projects. And it's the largest companies in the world that can build industrial-scale solar plants at 2 megawatts or 4 megawatts or 8 megawatts or 12 megawatts without any public subsidy. So the goal of the bill is to create an industry to be ready for the inevitability, not the possibility, the inevitability that solar energy be the cheapest way to make electricity worldwide in approximately a decade. Members, I want to immediately address the concern that it might not be sunny enough here to be a leader on solar energy. If we were having this meeting in Germany, which admittedly is an economy 10 times larger than Minnesota, we would be talking about how to get solar energy installed here up from 30,000 megawatts to 60,000 megawatts. Well, again, admittedly, we're only a tenth the size of Germany, but we have every bit advanced industrial economy. We have every bit as town and labor pool. We would have today installed in Minnesota 3,000 megawatts if we were doing as well as Germany. That's what we would have today, but instead we have 13. Now, you might think, okay, what does Germany have that we don't have? The strange irony is the map that was passed out that shows that Minnesota is only about half as good as Arizona on solar energy. Germany doesn't have any community anywhere in Germany that has a solar resource as good as Minnesota's worst community. Every single community in Germany has solar resource that's worse than Minnesota. So it is plenty sunny enough here to build an industry if it's sunny enough in Germany. Members, imagining then that we're going to build an industry, we're going to develop a technology, we're going to develop the jobs, competitive prices, so that we're ready when solar energy is the cheapest energy source worldwide, I think we should look a little bit at the policy model we're choosing.
This policy model is pretty well tested and pretty well understood. It's exactly the same policy model as the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard, which was a smash success. Our organization worked on, and if I may brag, had a key leadership role in helping to pull together industry and utilities and environmental groups and rural economic interests and county commissioners and wind farmers and wind farmer wannabes to pass the Renewable Energy Standard in historic vote in 2007, which I think only 13 members in both bodies voted no. And what happened from the Renewable Energy Standard is that we knew that wind energy was going to be a little more pricey at first, but that if we built an industry, the price of wind energy would come down fast. And now we know that we have a $10 billion wind energy business that's been developed from 2007 through 2020. About 70% of that is already under contract and installed. And for 11 out of the 13 largest utilities in Minnesota, there's basically been no impact on rates or slightly negative pressure on rates. So that's the exact same policy mechanism we're asking the legislature to adopt for solar energy. Now, a thoughtful question is, well, why wasn't solar energy helped by the Renewable Energy Standard? And the answer is, the purpose of the Renewable Energy Standard was to drive renewable energy procurement at the lowest possible cost. And so even though we have an industry in wind power that's getting up to around 5,000, 6,000 megawatts, our industry in solar energy is still around 10. It basically has been of no advantage. The Renewable Energy Standard has been of no advantage to the solar energy industry because it's not the least cost. Now, you're going to hear a lot of jargon as we talk about this whole idea of a value of solar tariff. I apologize for anybody who has to hear the term value of solar tariff. Let's call it what it actually is. Paying solar what it's really worth. That's what a value of solar tariff is paying solar what it's really worth. So what is solar energy worth?
We have three more witnesses, so if you can...
I'm very close to the end of my testimony, Madam Chair. And am I over my 4 minutes?
You are.
Okay, would you
give... Only a little bit.
Would you grant me another...
Two.
Two? Thank you, Madam Chair. When we talk about what is solar energy really worth, solar energy always shines on peak demand, so on the hottest summer day, solar energy is always there adding to the supply. Solar energy is delivered exactly where it's needed, doesn't need any power lines to be built to get it there. There's no losses of transmission lines. There's no penalty of fuel price risk or need for utilities to hedge against risk of gas markets or future risks of carbon regulations the federal government might deal with. So solar energy has all these benefits, and the solar energy installers want to be paid what it's worth. That's the value of solar. Now, if you add up all these value of solar ideas, which are legitimate, and there might be some debate on the margin whether there's six different values of solar that have to be captured or there's eight, I mean, that might be a legitimate debate. But once we add up all the value of solar, it's not going to be enough for these small homeowner projects, and it's not going to be enough for the small commercial projects. So in the bill, what we're calling a subsidy, which I prefer to call an incentive, politics work better for me, the solar energy incentive in the bill is only about a 1% or 1 1/3% cost, and that's what we're going to pay to get this industry that's going to provide us the least cost electricity. And in conclusion, Madam Chair, Fresh Energy came to this position gradually and slowly because our whole history of our organization's work has been to support least-cost energy. The very first bill we supported up here in 1990 required least-cost utility planning, and our bread and butter is to fight for the least-cost energy over the whole history of our organization. And now we're here in front of you today saying solar energy is not the least cost, but we should get started on it right away because it's going to be a big opportunity for us and will provide long-term, low-cost, reliable electricity, as this legislature has always done historically.
Thank you for your testimony. I know we have two member questions. We'll let the guy who's turning 50 today ask one question, and then we'll go on to the next testifiers. Representative Kelly.
You would have to move on to someone else. I'm not quite turning 50.
Oh, Representative Garofalo has misled us.
Don't help me in front of him. What are you doing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question. You're talking about solar being the cheapest form in the next 10 years or by the next decade. I'm just curious, what's going to get it there? Why isn't it there now?
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, there's two components to the cost of solar. One is the technology cost or the hard cost, And two is the soft costs, or the labor costs, the installation costs, the technologies of getting it on the building, and all the red tape and bureaucracy the government and utility imposes on the solar industry. What we actually need is we need a Solar Cost Reduction Act of 2013 to drive down the cost of solar by cutting red tape and bureaucracy and things that government and utilities do that make solar more expensive than it needs to be.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Into the testify, I've heard you name technology as probably the driving force right there. And Representative Falk, I think, talked about we got to look at this as an investment. From my mind and from my business, if I'm looking at the investment, why would I invest in something right now that I know would have to be, if it's going to be there in 10 years, why would I look at it, doing it now so I'd have to make a new investment in 10 years for the cheapest form of energy and the best technology at that time? I think we have to keep that in mind as to when we're going to invest in solar so that it actually is the best alternative.
Thank you, Representative Kelly, and I apologize for Representative Garofalo misstating your age. Mr. Noble, did you have a quick response?
Yes, a quick response is Representative Kelly is correct. I refer to being at the leading edge is the penalty of taking the lead, and I refer to hanging back and waiting till the technology is more ripe is the value of being behind. And the good news is that the Germans are the ones who had to pay the penalty of taking the lead. And the Minnesotans are going to be having the value of having been a little bit behind. The solar energy that we're going to install is going to be at $2 and $3, and the solar energy that they installed was at $20 or $16 or $12. So we're going to be installing solar energy at approximately one-tenth the cost that the German ratepayers paid to build the industry that they built. And that's the value of going slow and being prudent and being cautious. And that's what this bill is all about, is prudence and caution.
Okay. Thank you. Our next testifier is Mr. Bruce Stenswick from Eden Prairie.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
While we're waiting for the testifier to come down, if we could, the testifier who just left from Fresh Energy, gentleman from Fresh Energy.
Ross, Abby.
Sorry. If you could, we don't have time for it, so we want to make sure we get everyone. But if you could just supply an answer to the committee. We've cited Germany multiple times. And as everyone knows, or I think people who have researched Germany knows, that right now they're in a coal power plant boom. Now they're building more coal, using more coal. The United States is exporting coal to Germany. I would think that Fresh Energy would be against those sorts of policies taking place here. You don't need to answer it now, but if sometime in the future you could explain why the explosion in coal usage in Germany as a result of this is good for our state's policy.
Mr. Stenswick, go ahead.
Yes, I'm generally in favor of the bill, mostly because of concerns of greenhouse gases, and I believe that photovoltaics have potential to allow us to shut down our peaking power plants, which I know is junking good equipment, but I believe that's what's absolutely necessary. I think the amount we should have should be the 10% or enough to shut down our peaking power plants, whichever is less. If 10% is not enough to shut down our peaking power plants, then we should increment it every year after 2030 until we get enough solar to shut down our peaking power plants. I sent an email to my representatives, and I CC-copied you guys, explaining a method that I think you can use to ensure that we get solar at the lowest possible price. And if we don't want to drive up electric rates, you could fund this with tax credits. I understand the implications of trying to figure out if you're going to give tax credits for this, where are you going to counterbalance that to get the revenue to offset the tax credits. But I believe that we, from my point of view, being a native Minnesotan, we haven't had real winter in 15 to 20 years. I believe we have an obligation to deal with climate change, regardless of what anybody else is doing. We have to be prudent in it. But it is grossly irresponsible to pretend that it doesn't exist, to pretend that the consequences are not more severe than dealing with it.
Thank you. We're already over time. Members, if you can give me 4 more minutes, we can give each of the last witnesses 2 minutes. Alan Muller? Is Alan Muller here? Then our last testifier is Logan Bailey. Thank you, Mr. Bailey. I understand you may have come from Duluth today to
yes,
be with
that's
us.
Yes, true.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Logan Bailey. I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota Duluth in Water Resources. I'm also on the State Board of Directors of MPIRG, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. I'm supporting this piece of legislation as a Minnesota youth. It's very important to me that we create a strong solar energy market in our state. And not only will today's youth have to live with the long-term repercussions of today's energy policy, but we also be the ones tasked with solving that our future energy problems. And so I, as a young research scientist, I understand that opportunities afforded to young science and engineering students often have a major impact in shaping what specific fields and industries they end up in the future. So creating a more sustainable energy policy now will provide more opportunities for students to gain experience in solar energy fields. We'll attract the innovators and entrepreneurs of tomorrow to a growing field open to fresh ideas and innovation. So getting more science and engineering students involved in solar energy fields, it's going to be extremely beneficial to us as Minnesota, our energy problems, not just today, but also for decades in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here, and thank you, members, for coming early and staying late. Just a heads up to not plan lots of things on your calendar for the night of Monday, March 4th, and the night of Monday, March 11th, we're going to have to at some point start amending and voting on bills. And I want to make sure people have enough time to ask questions and have the conversation before we vote on things. And so we have booked extra committee time. And we've also booked the committee to start at noon for the foreseeable future so that we have enough time. Representative Morgan, some closing comments?
Thank you. Just briefly, Madam Chair, I want to tell the stakeholders that I was up there madly taking notes, and I look forward to working with all of you to attempt to address your concerns and move forward with solar energy. It's important to remember there are already 16 states that have a solar standard. In these states, the growth in the solar industry has come from the strong market signal that a standard has sent. I hope to address your concerns, but I believe firmly that we can set a strong, achievable, reasonable standard that will create jobs, bring business to Minnesota, and invest our own energy dollars here in Minnesota instead of in other states and countries. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, have you read the minutes?
No, Madam Chair, I have not. But I will move them.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes from the last meeting. All those in favor of the adoption of the minutes, please vote aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please vote no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The meeting is adjourned.